Hello from London on what's been a very mild January day. Welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. I'm Nancy Durham, and I'm delighted to be back in the city after a fabulous festive break. And coming up in this hour, well, what contrast to my farm in Wales. We're going to get the scoop on sumo wrestling in Japan and how the sport is big business, not just big athletes.
There's no advertising. The advertisers can only buy banners, which are shown around the ring before certain wrestlers bout.
We'll visit a controversial New York exhibit where artists are exploring last summer's Norwegian killings on Utøya Island.
It is a very tragic event. What I wanted to do was address the foreshadowing and the aftermath of this tragedy.
And we'll find out how the skiing industry is reshaping the business landscape as well as the mountains of China. All that plus some great music here on Midori House, live from Studio One in London. First, let's get the latest news from around the world with Louise Banbury.
Monocle 24 News with Louise Banbury. The White House said today it is working to verify reports that an Iranian court has sentenced American citizen Amir Mirza Hekmati to death. White House spokesman Tommy Vietor said that if true, they strongly condemn the verdict. Hekmati, a 28-year-old former US military translator, is an Iranian-American dual citizen who was arrested last month. Iran accuses him of being a spy for the CIA. Nigerian police have shot dead a man at a demonstration in Lagos and wounded three others, according to witnesses and hospital staff. Police also fired live ammunition and tear gas to disperse a crowd of protesters in the northern city of Kano, wounding at least 18. Thousands of Nigerians took to the streets to launch a nationwide strike to protest against the axing of a popular fuel subsidy. Swiss National Bank Chairman Philipp Hildebrand has resigned over a controversial currency trade made by his wife. Hildebrand's decision to step down from one of the top 10 central banking jobs in the world came as Swiss parliamentarians met to discuss the scandal. Hildebrand had resisted calls to step down, rejecting claims in the media that he had personally authorised the currency deal. But he told a news conference today he could not provide final evidence that he had been unaware of the trade.
Conscious as I am of the challenges currently facing our country, and given my responsibility for my office and for the SNB as an institution, I have therefore decided to relinquish my post with immediate effect.
A Pakistani minister has said that former President Pervez Musharraf will be arrested upon his return to Pakistan. Yesterday, Musharraf addressed a rally via video link in Karachi and announced his plan to return to the country to participate in a parliamentary election due by 2013. He faces the threat of arrest on charges that he failed to provide adequate security to former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto before her assassination in 2007. Manzoor Wasan, Home Affairs Minister for Sindh Province, said that Musharraf would be detained as soon as he landed at Karachi Airport. British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg hosted a meeting in London today of his Liberal allies from around Europe. He was hoping to promote his agenda of re-engagement with the European Union after the UK vetoed an EU treaty in December. The Dutch Prime Minister and the German Economy Minister were among the senior Liberal figures who joined Clegg at the mini-summit. At the start of the meeting, Clegg warned against needless rivalry among European governments.
I think it is immensely important that we work as Liberals in all of our different countries, in all of our different ways, to promote unity over disunity and to promote cooperation rather than needless rivalry or isolation.
The Sea France car ferry group has gone into liquidation, dashing hopes of a last-minute rescue. Employees demonstrated outside a Paris court as the ruling was handed down. Sea France employs 800 people in France and about 100 in Britain. The failure comes at a particularly sensitive time for President Nicolas Sarkozy, who is expected to face elections this spring. But, speaking from Germany, he said he was not giving up hope.
Je crois pouvoir dire.
I think I can say that we'll find a solution. At least that's what we are aiming for all the employees of Sea France. I won't give up and I won't accept any kind of fate. I think there is a solution, and the government has decided to do anything it can to achieve this goal.
Three valuable works of art, including one by Pablo Picasso and another by Dutch painter Pierre Mondrian, were stolen from Greece's National Gallery. Thieves broke into the gallery in the early hours this morning. They snatched Picasso's 1939 painting, Woman's Head, donated to the Greeks by the artist in 1949, and Mondrian's Mill, dated 1905. They also took a sketch by Italian painter Moncalvo. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
And I thank you, Louise. Now let's go to Tomasz Szafranaker, who has the global outlook on the weather.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
First, a look at Europe, and mostly good news this week. Many major European cities will have calm weather with some sunshine. You might be unlucky and catch a little rain early in the week in Germany, for example, but by Tuesday, the sun should be out again. Overall, nowhere near as windy and rainy as last week and relatively mild for January. Certainly won't feel like the middle of winter across western parts of Europe. Here's Tuesday's City Outlook, and in London, a very mild 12 degrees and partly cloudy. In Berlin, also not cold, 8 Celsius, partly cloudy. Oslo, 2 degrees, also a few clouds. In Milan, 8 Celsius and sunny. North America now, quiet weather across most of the US for the time being. There are some storms at the moment across Texas and the Mississippi Valley. Later in the week, rain all the way from Florida through Washington right up to New England. So snow in the Midwest and Canada expected as well. Here's Tuesday's City Outlook. In Toronto at the moment, plus 5 degrees and partly cloudy. New York City, 10 Celsius and sunny. In Dallas, 18 with thunder showers. And in San Francisco, 15 Celsius and sunny. Sunshine, and that's how it'll stay in San Francisco all week and probably into the weekend as well. Other world destinations for the next few days. In South Africa, Cape Town, 30 degrees and higher, sunny. Johannesburg, 28 Celsius with thunder showers, humid here too. And in Japan, winter weather in Hokkaido and Honshu, cold winds and snow flurries all the way from Sapporo to Nagano, around freezing here by day. That's all. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranaker here on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e io cosa?
Tama on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And as our regular listeners will be aware, we also make Monocle magazine here at Midori House. The magazine is split into five fields: affairs, business, culture, design, and edits. That's A, B, C, D, E. And each weekday, Midori House likes to take a look at one of them. Of course, today it's Monday. That's A, it's affairs. And Monocle's foreign affairs editor, Steve Bloomfield, is with me to take us around the world. And Steve, Hello there. I do see a little note here. We're going to start with Europe's never-ending financial crisis, and I so want that never-ending to go away. Can you make us happy?
No, I can't. I'm afraid. One hopes it will end at some stage, but it really is. I was going to say the gift that keeps on giving. What's the opposite of that? The booby prize
the
that keeps on
that doesn't stop repeating exactly. itself. But okay, yeah. So Angela Merkel is centre stage at the moment, right?
She is indeed, yes. So this week there are two sort of hopefully quite key meetings. Today Angela Merkel has been meeting with Nicolas Sarkozy. They are without doubt the two most important people in Europe right now. They're the ones who are most likely to get us out of this crisis, if anyone can. On Wednesday, she's also then going to be meeting with Mario Monti, the new Italian prime minister. So that will be partly to see, you know, how well he's doing. I mean, in a way, you know, she's calling him into the headmistress's office to check up on him.
Report card. After he's barely had 5 minutes, right?
Exactly. You know, she was very keen for him to be prime minister in the first place. There was a story a little earlier, I think at the end of last year, about how she'd spoken to Napolitano, the Italian president, and suggested that maybe, you know, Mario Monti would be the best person to appoint as prime minister. So there's all sorts of issues within Italy as well about what they see as German interference in their politics and their economy. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. One other event this week on Europe and the financial crisis, which is which could be very important, and that is tomorrow, Tuesday, Greece will be attempting to sell off some of its debt. They're going to have an auction for their treasury bills. This is pretty much the only way that Greece is able to raise money, and it will be a really good indicator of how bad the current situation is, depending on the price.
What price they get exactly for their debt.
What price they get and whether they sell it all that they're trying to shift. So that will be something to look on. So there's sort of three events this week which will have some sort of influence over the European crisis.
And in all that activity, is there one thing we just sort of really keep our eyes and ears open for?
Possibly what happens today with Merkel and Sarkozy. And I think these things, they're, I think as we've seen over the past few months, very incremental steps. Bits of progress are made, and often there's a summit, there's a big event, it looks like we're out of the woods, or we're slightly out of the woods, or we can at least see there might be a way out of the woods, and then 2 weeks later it all falls apart. So I mean, I'd like to be more hopeful, but I can't.
Okay, let's go south. Okay. Nigeria is
yes
on your list.
So Nigeria, very interesting actually what's been happening there. In sub-Saharan Africa, there have been no Arab Spring. We talk about the Arab Spring, but actually all these countries that it's happened in are African. It's Egypt, it's Tunisia, it's Libya. They're all African countries. But south of Sahara, although there's been protests in countries like Uganda and Senegal, there's been nothing that has really sort of
shaken the foundations.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Yeah. Now, what's happening in Nigeria is very interesting. The government of Goodluck Jonathan announced that on January the 1st, he would end petrol subsidies. This was worth about $8 billion and was keeping the price of petrol artificially low. In the 8 or 9 days since then, the price has doubled from, I think it was $1.60 a gallon to $3, just over $3. Huge price increase, which has then led to increases in costs of obviously transportation, food, pretty much everything. As soon as you start thinking about what petrol is used for, particularly in a country with very poor electricity grids, which rely on generators a lot, this has had huge effects. So it's been widespread protests. They turned a bit violent today. Two people were apparently killed. A national strike has been called for Monday.
Is it too naive a question to say, why did he have to increase it so much or let it go?
I think partly it was a financial thing, trying to save some money and thinking about how money should be best spent. Partly an economic philosophy that, should the government really be subsidising petrol? It's backfired politically, certainly. He's under fire a lot from not just the opposition, but from people within his own party. And what's interesting is the language that these protests are using. A lot of people are calling this Occupy Nigeria. So taking the language from the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations and using that in Nigeria. And again, it's worth just quoting this. One of the opposition party representatives said, and I won't pronounce his name because I can't, there exists a 1% cabal. So very much, again, using this language of, this is the 1% in Nigeria that is, and the rest are with the 99%.
Okay.
Certainly one to watch. And also one that really hasn't been on the radar of many other sort of mainstream news outlets.
If we have time. There's so
very
much to
quickly
cover in these sessions, but Ahmadinejad, the man from Iran, is on a South American tour. Can you just tell us what that's all about quickly?
Very quickly, yes. He is in Venezuela today. Then he heads off to Ecuador, Nicaragua and Cuba, part of a trip hoping to extend his influence throughout that region. It comes at a time when he's under a bit of pressure himself over the state of the economy back at home, and also obviously the tensions that we all know about between Iran and the West that have been ratcheted up over the country's nuclear ambitions. But proof that he does have some friends.
Thank you, Steve Bloomfield, our friend here at Monocle Magazine, the foreign affairs editor. Thanks very much. We are going to take time now for a song. This is Cut Copy with Where I'm Going. How nice is that song? Again, the group is Cut Copy. They're from Australia. The song was Where I'm Going. I really like that. I think they have been inspired by the Beach Boys. Very nice choice there. Well, in just a moment on Midori House, where we'll be going is to look at the ski market boom in China. There, resorts are being built on a major scale with the help of international consultants.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham, on Monocle 24 Radio. Now, China's ski industry has seen huge growth over the last few years, with new resorts popping up at a faster rate than many of its European and US counterparts. It seems China is becoming a serious competitor in the ski travel industry. Well, earlier, our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, caught up with ski resort consultant Justin Downs and began by asking him how long he's been involved with the ski industry in China.
I first came to China in 2006 with a North American firm called IntraWest. IntraWest was the largest developer of resorts in North America until the economy started to fall apart, and we came here to start a division called IntraWest China. And we started off by acquiring the land and the rights to develop five existing ski resorts in northeast China. And with our marquee resort development being Yabuli, which is in the far northeast province of Heilongjiang province. And we spend about $120 million redeveloping that to a world-class destination resort, of which now most people know it as operated as Club Med Yabuli. So the first Club Med resort to be operated in China.
Since then, things have sort of taken off with the China ski industry, or certainly it's something that everybody's talking about in the industry, but maybe it hasn't taken off quite as quickly as people would have hoped. Is that true, do you think?
To a certain extent. I mean, it hasn't declined, but it certainly hasn't increased at the rate people would have thought. I think that the reason for that is that the quality of the experience 5 years ago was pretty mediocre, to put it nicely. And it's been over the last 5 years that investment has come in. People are starting to want to experience a better quality of product, and it's taken that amount of time for the product to catch up with the expectations. Now that has started to come to be, and there's a better variety, better quality, better value, better all-around experience, people are going back and trying it for a second and third time, whereas before it was what I used to call a turn and burn. They come once and would never come back.
Yeah.
Now that the product is there, the numbers are starting to increase year on year.
And by people, do you mean mainly Chinese people, or is that sort of growing international ski tribe as well?
It certainly hasn't hit the international radar, except for your diehard bucket list type of skiers who want to say that they've skied in China. I mean, the quality of product, as far as the size of the mountains and the volume of snow and all this type of stuff, I mean, there are certainly better places to ski in that regard. But from a cultural experience, people are starting to want to try it out and, you know, experience what skiing in China is like. But by far, it's, I'd say, high 90 percentiles are our local population.
And you mentioned there about what skiing in China is like. What is skiing in China like?
Well, to be honest, it's predominantly man-made snow. I mean, China is a fairly dry country to start with, certainly in the northeast where, or certainly in the north where, you know, you're predominantly surrounded by desert. So we don't get a lot of natural snow. So it's all man-made snow. I mean, you can, up in the northern parts, you might be blessed with, you know, a 20 or a 30 centimeter snowfall, you know, once every 6 to 8 weeks, something like that. But, you know, it's a fairly tame ski experience to that extent. And to be honest, that actually suits the local market because they're not hardcore skiers. They don't know what to do in waist-deep powder. The runs are relatively short by international standards, but that suits what the locals require. And to that extent, you know, there's plenty of that on offer.
And obviously, I mean, we talk a lot about the luxury markets in China, or luxury goods markets, sorry. This is in many ways quite similar to that, isn't it? It's a borrowing from the West and seeing what people like to do with a lot of money in the West on their holidays, sort of transferring that and maybe making it a little bit Chinese at the same time. But do you feel that it's one thing to have fake snow and a good quality ski resort, but to create the whole experience, you sort of need the hotels, the restaurants, the transport infrastructure to get there easily, to complete the experience. Is all of that being put in place too?
It hadn't been in the past, which is, if I refer back to my earlier comment 5 years ago, it was band-aided together. It really was not a cohesive experience, a fully well-rounded offering. Now that's starting to come together in conjunction with private investment, quality operators, and government support. So the infrastructure is coming, and probably even more so than in a Western environment. The actual ski experience needs to be more rounded and more on offer than you might find in Europe or in North America or for wherever for that matter, because the Chinese population are not the type of people that want to ski from 9 to 5 every day. They want to have a few runs, then they want to go off and do lots of other activities. They want to bring multi-generations, bring their children, their grandparents, you know, people who have never even seen snow possibly. So there needs to be so much more on offer for a ski destination or a snow destination in China than there would be anywhere else in the world. And that is now starting to come together.
And how many resorts are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm working on 4 active projects. I've been involved with now 12 projects that have been constructed throughout the country at varying levels of development, some new builds and some redevelopments. But the more interesting side, well, not the more interesting side, but the probably more interesting from a Western perspective is that before, the attention was just on winter development. Now it's on four-season development. So people are really trying to bring people out into the clean, cooler, fresher air in the summertime and not just in the winter, which was something that was not apparent at all 5 years ago.
And as with so much of this sort of rapid building that goes on in China, it happens so quickly that quite often sort of things get built, but then you need to slightly educate the public in, you know, how to use it. And is there a sort of program in place where there's a lot of sort of publicity and things being given to these resorts and saying, actually, you know, it's not just for the odd ski weekend in winter, but you can use it in summer too, and it's a place to sort of go and take your family?
Yeah, certainly that is becoming more sophisticated. But I would say that there is, and along with many things in China, and maybe not such a bad thing, but, you know, there is a definite build it and they will come mentality that has prevailed in the past. And so they're building, the developers are building things that are very, very large and very expensive by what the economy might otherwise suggest, as far as, you know, they haven't really put a lot of thought into where is the customer going to come from, how much are they willing to spend, how much time do they have, all of this type of stuff. So that is starting to become a little bit more sophisticated, but by no means would the economies of it all stack up as compared to a North American product or a European product. So there is definitely a greater requirement for kind of asset utilization, so they don't want to see things sitting dormant for 8 months of the year, definitely because they're bringing in a lot of international hotel operators who have a far more detailed criteria and, you know, far higher expectations for their year-round occupancy. And certainly some of these places, given their remoteness, are obviously heavily dependent on where are they going to get the good quality staff from. So in a lot of cases, the resorts are focusing heavily on programs to keep their staff in place just so that they can offer a high quality and consistent product on a year-round basis from the from the staffing's perspective.
And that was ski resort man Justin Downs talking with Monocle's Hugo MacDonald. In the next half hour, we're going to be finding out what's going on at the Tokyo Grand Sumo Tournament. And we'll also visit a New York art exhibition, which has last summer's Norwegian killings at the center of it. But first, here's the news with Louise Banbury.
Thanks, Nancy. Two bombs have exploded near Shiite pilgrims travelling through Iraq's capital Baghdad, killing at least 15 people and wounding 52 others, according to police and hospital sources. The White House said it is working to verify reports that an Iranian court has sentenced American citizen Amir Mirza Hekmati to death. The 28-year-old former US military translator was arrested last month on charges of spying for the CIA. The United Nations nuclear watchdog has confirmed that Iran has started enriching uranium at an underground site and said all atomic material there was under its surveillance. Police have shot dead two protesters and wounded more than two dozen as thousands of Nigerians demonstrated against the axing of fuel subsidies. Police fired bullets and tear gas to disperse protesters in Lagos and in the northern city of Kano, killing one in each city. Swiss National Bank Chairman Philipp Hildebrandt has resigned over a controversial currency trade made by his wife. A Pakistani minister has said that former President Pervez Musharraf will be arrested when he returns to Pakistan to take part in elections. The Sea France car ferry group has gone into liquidation despite last-minute rescue bids. About 800 workers face unemployment in France and Britain. And three valuable works of art, including one by Pablo Picasso and another by Dutch painter Pierre Mondrian, have been stolen from Greece's National Gallery. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Louise. In just a moment, we're going to hear why a group of international artists have chosen last summer's Norwegian killings as the theme for a New York exhibition. But first, some music. This is Glenn Lewis, and Don't You Forget It.
Far away from the life so young, that's when you used to know. Cast your fears aside. Oh, la la la.
My producer Paul Noble and I just had the exact same thought, that Glenn Lewis there singing Don't You Forget It is really sounding an awful lot like Stevie Wonder. Now, a new exhibit, just opened in New York, was inspired by last summer's bombing and shootings in Norway. The art on show at Parallax Views also explores the perhaps less discussed theme of race relations and immigration in Norway. Monocle contributor Barrett Austin went to the gallery to find out more.
Well, it's very meditative. The woman is moving in slow motion. The scene on the right is very somber, and the music is kind of mournful, nostalgic.
I'm Koan Jeff Bisa. I'm the physician curator for this exhibition that's entitled Parallax Views at the NO Gallery in New York City. Our Parallax Views has to do with the difference between two perspectives. The example would be a person looking at a dial speedometer. Looking at it head-on, you'd see the correct mileage, but a person sitting in the passenger seat looking at the same needle would see a different speed. So it's a difference in perspective.
And could you just tell us a little bit about the actual exhibition itself?
Yeah. Well, the exhibition arose from an interest I have in subcultures, cultures nesting within other cultures. Years ago, I did an exhibition called D'Afrique d'Asie, in which I looked at the ideas of Asia and Africa not being in the same mental set. And so I put together a list of artists who were actually addressing those issues. So the same idea was for Parallax Views. And it started off basically as a concept of Africans in Oslo. But when I was doing the research, I found that that exhibition had already been done. So I still wanted to do something about immigrants to Norway, especially with the views about multiculturalism that have been espoused by the French and British leaders. And so I thought of this idea of immigrant artists to Norway who are residing in Norway and the reaction to a recent event, the tragedies of July 22nd, 2011, with Breivik and the shootings and bombings.
And tell us a little bit about a little bit more about the artists themselves. Who are they? How were they selected?
Yeah, the selection was actually quite a lengthy process because I started off with artists who had shown in Oslo before that were of multi-ethnic origin. And when I did the research into that, I found that the issues that they addressed weren't exactly what I had wanted. So I went to several websites of Norwegian artists who signed up to pay on this website and actually canvassed about 40 artists and narrowed it down to the number of artists we have in this exhibition.
Tell us a little bit about how you were attracted to the idea of curating this specific show. Do you have any personal connections to Norway? What was your situation, you know, in terms of dealing with the actual attacks?
Actually, it wasn't so much the episode itself that drew me to this. I've always worked with Norwegian artists, but based in New York. And I was approached by this gallery, the New Gallery, which specializes in showing the works of Norwegian artists. So I actually was approached by them to do this. And in my research, found that this area of interest in terms of subcultures is what I want to explore.
And so none of the artists that are on display here in the show, none are actually native-born Norwegians, right?
No, it's true that they're all immigrants. All but one reside in Norway.
And what do you think the difference is in terms of, I guess, the dialogue that's shown here? How is this different from a show where you might have had native-born Norwegians displaying their works?
Well, the whole immigrant issues that have been raised by the shootings and bombings are things that have galvanized the artistic community. So the initial reaction, of course, has been shown in the media that they thought an outsider was responsible, whereas it was a true Norwegian that was actually committing the tragic events. And so the perspective was one of great caution, especially compounded with the multicultural issues that I mentioned earlier. And this is a response. What I didn't want to do is like take a really heavy-handed approach to the subject. It is a very tragic event. What I wanted to do was address the foreshadowing and the aftermath of this tragedy.
So for many around the world, Norway would seem like a most unlikely place for such a vile act of terrorism. What do you think this says? What do you think the act itself says in sort of Norway's response? What does it say for the place of multiculturalism in Norway today?
Yeah, I think Norway is one of the great social democrat countries in the world, and I think they have we know that they have a very high standard of living, high level of education, they take care of their citizens. I don't think this is really unique to Norway. I mean, this could have happened in any country. In fact, I did draw the parallels between Timothy McVeigh and Breivik, because these were individuals, the acts were considered, of course, terrible, but originally, the knee-jerk reaction was as a fundamentalist, someone else, other than an American, other than a citizen of the country.
That was Barrett Austin talking with Cohen Jeff Bisa at the No Gallery in New York. Parallax Views runs until the 29th of January.
Every Saturday, Monocle's editors team up with a lively mix of guests to take a leisurely look back at the week past and pull out their personal highlights, cultural, political, musical, cinematic, and more. Our Saturday show is the perfect accompaniment to the weekend papers and a good coffee. The Review comes to you in association with J. Crew every Saturday at 11 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24, and is also available on our timeshift player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
Culture with me, Robert Bounds, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended, and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
The January Grand Sumo Tournament is underway in Tokyo. You didn't know? Well, winning the title of Yokozuna, or Grand Champion, is a very highly appreciated and much celebrated position. Well, earlier today, Jonathan Openshaw talked with Monocle Tokyo correspondent Kenji Hall to find out why sumo has been one of Japan's biggest sporting draws for over 1,000 years. Jonathan began by asking Kenji what role sumo plays in the calendar.
So sumo has been around for It dates back several hundred years to the feudal period in Japan, and it has long-time associations with the native Shinto religion. And so the wrestlers themselves, they're not only athletes, they're also expected to uphold a certain dignity when they're both in the ring and outside of the ring. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of the scandals in recent years, and that's something to keep in mind.
Definitely. And which the event that we're talking about, this event that's running from the 8th to the 22nd of January, what is that? It's one of the Grand Sumo tournaments, and I believe there's six a year. Is that right?
There are six a year, and they're held all over Japan. It's a sort of a traveling circus, if you will. Each time, the wrestlers are split into two divisions, basically the top division, which is the Makuuchi division, and then there's a lower division. And each wrestler is actually ranked. And so when they go into the tournament, essentially they're seeded and they're divided into east and west. And so what ends up happening is over the course of 14 days, the wrestler with the best record will win. And normally there's a pretty clear winner. In cases where two or three wrestlers come out with the same record, there's a final sort of face-off.
And who's the favorite going to this event? Is there a big kind of superstar sumo wrestler? Is there the David Beckham of sumo?
The David Beckham of sumo, yeah. So the top-ranked wrestler currently is Hakuho, and he is what's called a Yokozuna, which translates loosely to Grand Champion. He's actually Mongolian, and this is something that has been sort of has caused an identity crisis, really, for the sport. For years now, the top-ranked wrestler has not been a Japanese wrestler. It's been almost 10 years. I think it's been 9 years since the sport had a Japanese Yokozuna. And so there's been a lot of sort of hand-wringing over how to get more lower-ranked Japanese wrestlers into the top ranks. Currently, what we're seeing, there are two Ozeki. This is the second rank below the Grand Champion. There two have been recently promoted. They're both Japanese, and one of them has become quite a fan favorite. His name is Kiseno Sato. And so there's a lot of expectation and hope, really, that he'll make it into the top rank eventually.
And now you mentioned that, so as well as competing as kind of competitive sports people, they're expected to uphold a certain level of dignity and set an example in Japanese society. This hasn't been the case in recent years, has it? Can you take us through a couple of the scandals that the sport's been blighted by recently?
Sure. So if we can dial back to last year, there was another grand champion. His name was Asa Shoryu. He was also Mongolian. He was essentially pushed out of the sport, forced to retire after having gotten into a bar brawl. And he had famously been involved in several incidents where he'd been reprimanded by the Japan Sumo Association. So this was sort of a long time in coming. Another example, last year we also saw a betting scandal. Now, it's illegal to bet on professional sports here, and to have the wrestlers doing it was just a huge, huge national scandal. Mm. At the same time, it also exposed the sport's links to the gangsters, the Yakuza. And as a result of that, what happened was public broadcaster NHK decided not to show one of the tournaments. And this was the first time that they had done this since the 1950s.
So where does this leave the standing of sumo in Japanese society then? Is it, I mean, obviously it's a very traditional sport. You said roots going back hundreds or even thousands of years. What's the relevance in modern Japanese society, especially when they see the sport undermined by this kind of behaviour?
Well, that's the big question right now. The sport is heavily subsidised by the government. It's shown on national, on the public broadcasters network, NHK, and they're essentially there's no advertising, or there's very little advertising. The advertisers can only buy banners, which are shown around the ring before certain wrestlers' bouts. But mainly, the sport is paid for by taxpayer dollars. And so the question is, what is its relevance in society? And a lot of people have wondered that, especially in recent years as the popularity of the sport has declined. At the same time, the current New Year tournament, which is being held in Tokyo, the first 2 days were sold out, and so it does seem like the sport has recovered somewhat. But I also want to mention last year that the Japan Sumo Association canceled the tournament for the first time since 1946 after about a dozen wrestlers allegedly were throwing matches in exchange for payment. Mm. So, you know, the sport has had a rough few years, and, you know, hopefully the fact that fans are coming back is good news for the sport.
Mm. And I just very quickly wanted to touch on the sponsorship aspect of the sport, because obviously the grand champion, the Yokozuna, is in a position to bring in a lot of heavy sponsorship deals. I'm just interested, for, you know, you hear about the reading the Japanese press, you hear about the kind of Joe DiMaggio of sumo, the David Beckham of sumo. Obviously, the sponsorship deals for these guys in the West, it's very much linked to the whole kind of cult of the body beautiful when you see people in sharp tailored suits, and it's that kind of, the sponsorship's linked with that kind of lifestyle. How does it play out in Japan then? Because obviously, not all of these guys are going to fit into a bespoke suit.
Yeah, so very rarely do you see these guys sporting bespoke suits, obviously. And, you know, in fact, it's actually rare to find the sumo in TV advertisements or other forms of commercial advertisements. Mostly, the advertisements are in the form of the banners that I mentioned that get paraded around the ring before matches. You know, for instance, if you were to look at most of the ads on the subway or the billboards, it's extremely rare to find wrestlers' faces on those. You know, to see a wrestler book up that quickly has invited the kind of allegations about doping and criticism for years now.
That was Jonathan Openshaw talking with our reporter Kenji Hall in Japan. And with us now in Studio One at Monocle 24, I have been joined by an Olympian in judo, I add, not sumo, and former vice president of the International Sumo Federation, Sid Hoare. Hi, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
You've been listening here with me and to the call to Japan. Okay, well, how did you get involved and taken in this amazing sport?
Well, it's an interesting story, actually. I was running a martial arts club in London, and I had some spare space, so I decided I'd start a sumo club up, and I just did it, and that was it, and it was sort of fairly successful. Then shortly after that, I had to go to Japan, and while I was there, one of the stable bosses approached me and said, "We understand you do sumo in London." So I said, "Yeah." He said, "Whoa." He said, "We'd like to invite you to bring a team out to fight in a couple of months' time."
In Japan?
Yeah. So we did, and it was quite interesting, actually. It was like something out of Godfather, because I turned up at this building in Tokyo, and then in this smoke-filled room where all these stable bosses and the like were sitting there looking very grim. And I was introduced, and my introducer, who was my one-time judo coach, explained a bit about me and said, "This is Sid Hoare. He trains here, does this, he does that." And they looked very stern, you know. I thought, you know, they're going to jump up in a minute and do, you know, assault me or something like that. But anyway, I was asked to say something at the end. And one thing I'd learned in Japan was the magic word is cooperation.
Okay.
And quite often speeches in Japanese end in, you know, "I beg for your cooperation."
Did they feel you weren't going to cooperate somehow? I mean, what was going on?
Well, I touched this button, you see, and I said cooperation, and their faces lit up, and they actually gave me a round of applause.
Great.
So that's how it all started, and I brought a three-man team out to Tokyo, and we had the matches. There were some other foreign teams as well. There was a mix. And we did rather well, I thought. We beat a few prefectural teams first off, and 3-0. And then from then it developed more and more and more.
Okay, now let's dispel some myths. Now, I know you're not a sumo champ, but you can do sumo or play it or whatever the right word is. But right now, people can't see you. You are a very slim, live, fit-looking gentleman. So one does not need to be jumbo-sized?
Well, In pro sumo, the bigger the better, really, because weight is a weapon, and you just win by pushing the other person out. And of course, if you're 20 or 30 kilos heavier than the other person, you can do it.
You've got the edge.
Yeah. Whereas in the ranks before that, in the amateur sumo, it's not so important weight, because a lot of the students will be quite lightweights. But I mentioned this because it's very interesting to see the lightweight sumo guys fight the heavyweight ones, because they have to rely on skill and technique, and it's amazing what some of the smaller ones can do in those amateur stables. And amateur sumo in Japan is very big.
Okay, and let's further into sort of dispelling myths. This is a very highly detailed sport, if I can put it that way. People who don't know about it look at it on television and perhaps laugh, just think it's funny. But it isn't. It's a very sophisticated sport, is it?
Well, it is very sophisticated. There's so many little facts to know about it. Everything seems to be in a hierarchy. For example, the barbers who look after the hairstyle of the sumo wrestlers,
yes,
they're ranked like the sumo wrestlers, and yet all they do is fix the hair. So there's all these hierarchies that exist all the way through it.
And they're tying it. Do they tie it back into a sort of tight little bun or ponytail or something?
What's
going on back there?
It comes back and then it folds forward.
So you've got to be very skilled at that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It takes them maybe 9 years to get qualified.
And what are they called then? A sort of sumo hairdresser?
Tokoyama.
Tokoyama. Mm. And then they're qualified and they're able to do that.
Yeah.
And what about there when you're out on the wrestling mat? Are they on a wrestling mat? All of a sudden I realize I'm no expert. I've just seen these large men throw each other around.
It is hard.
Okay.
And abrasive. So they're on there with their bare feet, and if they happen to skid around a bit, they can take the skin off the underside of the feet, or if they fall on it. And it's compacted clay. The actual ring is so many tons, can't remember exactly, it's a lot of weight, and built up into this heavy circle, and they take falls on that. It's not padded in any way at all.
Lots of injuries.
Yes, if you look at the matches, you'll see them with tapes all over the place. Wrists, ankles, elbows, take a lot of strain.
Now, why hasn't sumo taken off in a place like here in Britain, for instance, in the way that, say, judo and karate are very popular sports?
Well, there's a saying in Japanese, because look to the Japanese first. They're aware of this, but they say that in sumo there are the three Ks to beware of. One is kitanai, which means dirty. The other one is kako arui, which means doesn't look very good. And the other thing is kitsui, which means tight. Now, this refers to kitsui is the belt that goes on.
Okay.
And these three Ks are three reasons why not many people want to do sumo, even in Japan. The belt is tight, it pinches in hard, and it's heavy. They do it virtually naked, so they get covered in dust and dirt and all this sort of thing. And these things all contribute to, a lack of interest in doing the sport at pro sumo level.
So what you're saying is the Japanese have more stamina?
Yeah.
Perhaps.
For them, of course, it's so ancient. It goes back a couple of thousand years to ancient rituals in the paddy field, because sumo is very closely connected to the god of water. And water is very important for rice growing. So, of course, when they had their festivals, they would pull in the biggest men they could find. So bumper individuals equals bumper crops. And so eventually, if you wanted something to flourish, you would pull in some sumo men, say, look big, and you'd look for bumper results as well.
And they just accidentally bumped into each other and the sport got going? Is this what you're telling me?
Well, of course, this was a religious ritual in the temples, and it would be attended by possibly the shogun, maybe members of the imperial family, and only in top-level shrines or temples dotted around shrines, basically. That's the Shinto version. And that's it. It's just like praying for crops. You hope for a good crop, lots of rice, and so hire a big guy to come along and do his little bit of sumo, and hopefully some of it will rub off.
And we're talking because this is the occasion of the first big tournament of 2012. There are going to be six. So this is a big deal. Start of a new year. Are the Japanese just fixed to their TVs and newspapers and to find out the results and find out how it's going? Or is it just for a select percent of the population?
There is a little bit of sense of times are changing, because go back, a couple of decades or so, where you had, say, about 30 years ago, you had all the Pacific Islanders, you know, from Hawaii, that dominated sumo. These were the massive guys who weighed 35 stone, British weight, I mean, very big men. And they eventually passed, you know, you only got a certain life in sumo. As long as you're winning, you stay there, but and they all start to lose at some point. And then after them, we got the Eastern Europeans coming in, the big Bulgarians and Estonians. So but my sense is that's slowly passing out. And if I was a Japanese sumo person and wanted to promote the sport, I would try and keep the foreigners out, the gaijin rikishi, but not from a position of weakness, but from a position of strength. You know, so once they've got a couple of grand champions who are winning on the east side and the west side, they can say, well, we don't need foreigners in sumo anymore. We can just stick to our own guys. They're as good as anybody else. That's what I would do.
But now the nation is fixed on it, is it?
Oh, yeah, But as I say, this sense of change. So they're thinking, oh, well, you know, Hakuho, of course, is the top man. He's a Mongolian, sort of one of us, I guess they might say. But then the Eastern Europeans are kind of moving out a bit. There are a few left.
Well, I'm going to start paying much closer attention to sumo, I have to say. And let me thank you, Sid Hoare, who is a sumo expert and a scholarly gentleman. You know Japanese to a degree. It's been very nice to have you in here to listen to you. Thank you very, very much.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Essa é Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
And a Monaco 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monaco 24. 24.
Well, that's it for the Monday edition of Midori House. It's time to thank my producer, Paul Noble, and researcher, Tom Hall. Our studio manager today was Alex Funnell. At 2200 London time, Emma Nelson and Sophie Grove will be here to bring you the Monocle Daily. We'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. The headlines are going to be next, right here on Monocle 24 Radio.